I noticed after I welcomed some other visitors that Bill Servin and Harriet are visiting from California still, I suppose, visiting Joy Walker. Bill was an usher at Plymouth for many years. I'm sure some of you remember him. I used to think that Bill Servin looked the way all ushers in elegant churches were supposed to look. He still looks distinguished. Welcome to this place. Every church has some special inconsistency all its own. Some area in which it preaches one thing and practices another. When I was a child, the great boast of my church was that we did everything the Bible commanded us to do. We were excessively proud of this claim. We like to say, where the Bible speaks, we speak. Other professed believers might ignore certain commandments, but not us. We obeyed all of them. I grew up to find out that we didn't. For example, Jesus fasted as part of his worship of God and clearly expected his disciples to do the same. When you fast, he said, as if there could be no doubt about it, and then went on to tell them exactly how to do it. But in my church, we never fasted. On the contrary, we often ate too much. At all those potluck dinners, after church, before class on Wednesday night, at picnics in the park. If someone asked why we did not fast, our scribes and lawyers, great at chopping logic and splitting hairs, would say, oh, fasting was simply a custom of those times and not really intended for us. And I did not notice as a child that they never bothered to explain how we knew that some commandments were customs and other commandments were commandments. Somehow we just knew. As I went along, testing what we did against what I was reading, I found other commandments which we ignored because they were not a part of our tradition, including one which is repeated a rather surprising 5 times. Not many imperatives in the New Testament are stated that often, so this one must have been fairly significant in the early church. Its first appearance is at the end of Paul's letter to the Christians at Thessalonica. Greet all the brethren with a holy kiss. Now, the word translated brethren must include both men and women, because at the end of 3 other letters, Paul simply says, greet one another with a holy kiss. He doesn't have to explain it. They obviously know what it is. The more you read about ancient customs, the more you realize that Christianity borrowed far more things than it created. And the kiss of greeting was one of the pleasant rituals it borrowed. Jesus rebuked a Pharisee one day for failing to give him a kiss of greeting when he came into his house, and he was especially appalled that Judas chose that intimate sign of respect and welcome to identify him to his enemies. Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? Since the early church was itself Jewish, the welcoming kiss was taken over and brought into worship with a stress on holiness and affection. The first epistle of Peter ends with this apostolic order: greet one another with the kiss of love. 15 years ago, when I first said something in a pulpit about the holy kiss as an example of the way we interpret the Bible literally on one point and very loosely on another, I read a couple of books which traced the whole history of the human kiss. The bulk of that research turned out to be not very useful for the pulpit. But I did learn that through most of history, women have preferred to be kissed by bearded men. And I found a wonderful little French story about a student who once took the liberty of kissing a young girl. She got very angry, or at least pretended to, and called him an insolent pup. He replied, "Pour Dieu," roughly equivalent to "for goodness sake," and went on to say, "Don't be cross, young lady. If that kiss annoys you, give it back to me." The story does not say whether she accepted his solution, but when one couple I read about had resolved to break off their engagement, the man said, "It is best, I suppose, that we return each other's letters." And the woman replied, "I think so too. But should we not, at the same time, give each other all our kisses back?" They did. And the engagement was on again. We know very little now about how the kiss of peace, or the holy kiss, came to be a part of early Christian ritual, except that, human nature being what it always has been, some problems arose, and the pleasant little ceremony had to be regulated. I did not find a definitive answer as to just when it took place in the worship. Both Origen and Tertullian among the old church fathers say that it was given after prayers. Justin Martyr puts it after prayer and just before communion. "Prayers being ended," he said, "we salute one another with a holy kiss, and then the bread and cup are brought to the president." I'm not sure what the president was, except that it seems the church was already learning how to elevate one person above another. If the early Christians had met in a special building like this one, where little or nothing happens during the week until we reconvene on Sunday, and where the whole ceremony is rather formal, the kiss of greeting might never have come into use. But most of their meetings were held in private homes, where it would seem a bit more natural to greet one another as the family greets its own members. Of the 30 or 40 commentaries I have looked at over the years, only a couple tried valiantly to claim that the kiss of greeting was always absolutely harmless. A French commentary on the book of Romans says, "Probably the president of the assembly gave the kiss to the brother who sat next to him, and he passed it to his neighbor, while the same thing took place on the part of the women." I think he must be only guessing, because Tertullian at the end of the second century speaks of a wife exchanging a kiss with, quote, any one of the brothers, and Clement of Alexandria complains of those who make the churches resound with their kissing, and goes on to say that the shameless use of a kiss occasions foul suspicions and evil reports. So I can only assume that by that time, the greetings at church were getting to be so much fun that the church had to come up with some new rules. And we actually find them in an ancient volume called The Apostolic Institutions, an important document for understanding what went on in the early church. This book lays down laws to remove from the holy kiss whatever might be offensive in it. It describes the worship, and then it says, these things being done, let the men apart and the women apart salute one another with a kiss in the Lord. Well, that sounds suspiciously like the kind of advice which comes after somebody has complained. Perhaps the most interesting comment is given by historian Will Durant in the magnificent volume called Caesar and Christ. And this is his paragraph. The final ritual of the agape, the love feast, was the kiss of love. In some congregations, this was given only by men to men and by women to women. In others, this hard restriction was not enforced. Many participants discovered an untheological delight in the pleasant ceremony, and Tertullian and others denounced it as having led to sexual indulgences. The church recommended that the lips should not be opened in kissing, and that the kiss should not be repeated if it gave pleasure. In the 3rd century, Mr. Durant tells us solemnly, the practice gradually disappeared. Hundreds of years later, in the middle of the 13th century, the kiss was reintroduced into England in what was held to be a harmless way of doing it. The osculatorium, or tabella pacis, a metal disc with a holy picture on it, was passed around in the church to be kissed by each member. But even this caused problems because people began to quarrel over who would have the honor of kissing it first. And as you might guess, it led to some other complications that no one had anticipated. When a young and beautiful girl kissed the little disc, she often found sitting beside her a young man waiting eagerly to take it directly from her hand and her lips. Well, so much for human frailty. The kiss commanded by Peter and Paul fell by the wayside long ago, a victim of our much cherished but often troublesome sexuality. And even the words of the 2 apostles are now translated by one modern version like this: give one another a hearty handshake all around. Now that really isn't a translation, of course, because it isn't what Paul and Peter actually said, but it catches the spirit of what they had in mind. And it reflects what the church decided to do a long time ago in order to avoid temptations and jealousies. Now, I hope you've been listening between the lines, because this sermon is not really meant to be no more than a lightly tossed salad for the summer pulpit menu. Quaint little notes about the history of the holy kiss are not very important. And I do approve of the ceremony Paul commanded being altered to a handshake, even when it turns out that the handshake is mostly a male performance. But there is a lesson in all of this which is important for understanding how Christianity relates to the book we call the New Testament. And that point is this. The New Testament is a document rooted in a particular time and place. It bears the marks of its own unique culture. And not all of it fits the one in which we live. Even those churches that claim to obey every word of it use it selectively. They may talk earnestly about how it is inspired and what this requires of a disciple, but the fact is that the many arguments about whether a male Christian had to be circumcised, over whether to eat a prime rib that had been offered up to a pagan god before it went into the butcher shop, over whether women have to cover their heads in church, and over how to make sense of the intricate legalisms of a book like Hebrews, or of the mysterious code language of a book like Revelation, all these things are largely irrelevant to the modern pulpit and the modern Christian. So each church makes its own adjustment to these things, develops its own tradition about which scriptures are vital and which are not, and then settles in, some churches at least, with the conviction that the choices it has made are the only true and right ones. My church, for example, made it essential to salvation to take communion every Sunday, although there is no command anywhere in Scripture that says we have to do that. But we then turned right around and totally ignored a direct command to wash one another's feet as part of our discipleship, and another direct command to anoint the sick with oil and have the elders visit to pray for them. Inconsistent? Yes. But it was our inconsistency, and we had learned to be comfortable with it. I remember that a young Methodist preacher asked me once when I was still in my teens, but was sure I had mastered all the essential religious truth, why wouldn't it be all right to use orange juice and graham crackers for communion, so long as we had the right motive and spirit about what we were doing? Well, I was too shallow to do more than laugh at his challenge to the relationship between form and spirit. And I passed what I considered to be his marvelous heresy on to some of our churches, and together we felt smug and superior for months. We knew the right things to use for communion. It was Welch's bottled grape juice, and those little overbaked Manischewitz crackers, which had been mass-produced in a factory for church use. Now, the early church, obviously, had used real wine and a rough-baked loaf of bread, so we had already come a long way from strict adherence to form, but it was our switch and our tradition, and so it was fine. The very basic notion that Jesus used wine and bread simply because they were staple foods and happened to be on the table that last night of his ordinary life did not occur to us. That cheap wine and homemade bread were simply a cultural accident, And that if the church had started in China, it would have used tea and rice, was not a concept we could have handled. But surely it would have amazed Jesus to suppose that someday, in some remote part of the world where bread and wine are not staple items of diet, a Christian missionary would insist on importing them so that people could commune correctly with their Lord. Now, I hope it's apparent by now that we have been considering the most basic of all the differences between churches. Is the New Testament a legal text with inflexible codes and unchangeable forms of worship and ritual? Or is it a dynamic book which captured the ferment and excitement of the early church and left us with a large amount of freedom in each generation to express that excitement and devotion in ways appropriate for our time and place? The gulf between those two approaches is so great that it is not likely to disappear. But here and there, we can bridge it. We can come to understand how traditions petrify into unyielding stone. And when our children get curious enough to ask us questions about their religion and the religions of their friends, we can have an answer for them that will help them live intelligently and with tolerance for all human frailty, including their own. And that's not a bad thought for a hot Sunday in July. Amen.